listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
And welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host today, Dr. Melody Fox, clinical psychologist and marriage family therapist. And I'm with you every Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Actually, we're in daylight savings time right now, as we bring you special guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing you answers and options to raising children today in our constantly changing future. Now, Answers for the Family addresses issues such as locating your runaway teen, introductions to different placements and treatment centers, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, or dealing with addictions, and many, many other subjects that I think is important for you as parents, professionals, and teachers need to know in order to support your teen into growing to be a healthy and happy adult and pursuing their dreams. As I'm sure many of you expected to hear Alan's voice this morning, we are reminded of the reality that what he does when he's not on the air, he is a licensed private investigator, a crisis interventionist, and a teen transporter. And he gets calls and has to respond quickly, be it locating a runaway, escorting a teen to a specialized program, or retrieving an abducted child. Although Alan usually doesn't miss the show unless it is business, I do believe he finally took a couple days off for himself, which is important for everyone to do now and again. And that includes parents and professionals that work with teens, as self-care is really important. Well, today I'm really excited to be speaking with Dustin Tibbetts, a licensed marriage family therapist, who is president and chief clinical officer, partner, interchange executive director of New Haven, as I'm sitting here fumbling around. And he is the founding employee of New Haven back in 1996, beginning as a staff supervisor working directly with girls. He coordinated the development of New Haven's Family Works approach, its values program, its clinical philosophy, and its extensive employee training program. And then in 2006, Dustin helped form Interchange and became a minor partner. He assisted with the purchase of Sunrise later that year and Fulshear Ranch Academy in 2007. Now, Dustin's mental health experience includes 17 years working with intensive inpatient residential treatment settings, outpatient therapy, transitional services, rape and suicide crisis hotlines, and he himself has raised 5 foster teenagers in his home. Well, Dustin, we are so happy to welcome you to Answers for the Family.
Thank you, Melody. Thanks for having me.
Well, you've done quite a bit, especially 5 teenagers, not only teenagers, but foster children, which usually come with a few more challenges. And that's just wonderful. Where are they all now?
They're scattered across the country. It was definitely a learning experience for me.
So I guess they're not teenagers anymore.
No, they're all grown up.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's good. Well, I know you have so much experience, especially at New Haven and Interchange, and I'm hoping we could talk a little bit about what you do there. But I know one of the things that you were interested in talking about was raising the bar for residential treatment. And we talked to a lot of different treatment centers here, and they talk about their programs, which is wonderful, because I think it's really important that parents and other professionals and teachers know the resources and the different opportunities and places that they could send their children for help when needed. And I was wondering if you could, from your point of view, talk about what raising the bar for residential treatment means for you.
I appreciate that. There's a lot of things I think that we can do better. Our industry, and I guess there are some people who would take exception to calling it an industry, but our industry is fairly young, maybe 20, 25 years in the private pay residential industry and for teens. And so I think we have a lot to learn from the medical field that has been around longer and done more than we have. But some of the things that I think we're still behind the ball on are outcomes research, for example.
Mm-hmm.
There's just not very many of us that really engage in really thoughtful and consistent outcomes research. And I know many of the boards that I sit on right now are trying to figure out how we can get each other to do that kind of thing.
Well, let's slow down for a minute. What does outcome research mean? What is that for people that may not know?
Well, I think when parents place their children with us, the key question they have in their hearts is this going to work? You know, are we going to be able to have our daughter back, at least in our cases when we treat daughters? And I think programs do a poor job in general of answering that question. I don't think that we always know if what we've done has worked or not, and we don't know if we can attribute it to the treatment that we gave them or to their own maturation, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it means a number of things. For us, we've decided that that we would measure outcomes based on three key factors. One of those is education. That, you know, did they get back on track for education? As many kids come in to our centers, behind in school. Another one would be, is the family connecting well, getting along well? You know, what's their experience together after treatment? Mm-hmm. And then the third piece would be, you know, how quickly did we get them back home, and how permanent was that in general? So I think that's a good start. If we could answer those questions, we'd be able to tell parents with some satisfaction and some certainty that their daughter was going to get, quote-unquote, well.
Sure. And so with that, if we were to get the outcomes, we would need to have people actually track that to see what's been going on with their program and then put it together as a whole. Do you think it should be mandated that every treatment program, is involved in some kind of research project where they could put all the information in together to see if you get the outcomes that you want, the children back to school, the family connectiveness, and back home quickly?
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant idea. I think, so I've talked with the National Association of Therapeutic Schools and Programs, who has been trying to get their membership to do outcomes research for the last almost 4 years now. And I've talked with the American Association of Child Residential Centers, who is just beginning to try to get their members to start doing collective research. The issue that comes up is, are we going to be comparing each other? Are we comparing apples to apples? What if my kids are worse, quote unquote, than your kids when they come in? And and if I'm going to be compared to you, I want to be compared fairly. So this sort of competitive sense kind of creeps in to the decision-making process, and it limits us, I think. I think most kids that come to us are similar more than different, and I think we need to set aside our fears. There are ways to collect research that keep people from, we have to protect confidentiality anyway, and it keeps people from comparing actual students or programs one to another in terms of who the kids were. So I think there are ways around it. We just haven't become creative enough to figure it out. We haven't had the political willpower to force this through. I think the time is now to change that and to start, you know, raising the bar for the whole industry in terms of what we collect and what we measure and who measures what and all that kind of thing.
Well, you had mentioned about the competitiveness between the programs, and I have seen that as a clinician who refers children to different programs. There seems to be a lot trying to get my attention on their programs better than this program because this program does this and that program doesn't and blah, 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 blah. And I try to look at the individual program for what it is and stands alone and then try to match the child that would be most appropriate with whatever program. But I think the competitiveness really needs to be set aside because basically I think it's important to just gather information, you know, to figure out, are we all on the same page? Are we not? You know, is that treatment program, they're doing eating disorders, but they keep them there for a year. How is that different from somebody who works with them for 30 days and gets them back home quickly? What's the difference, and what's the success rate between that?
Right. Yeah, and you have a lot of experience. I mean, you said you're a marriage and family therapist and a clinical psychologist, so you've seen this a lot.
A lot.
Yeah, you've been around the block quite a bit. Our CEO at Interchange, Lance Davis, likes to push back on me pretty hard and say, why are we doing what we're doing? And I think as we thought about that, the reason why we do what we do is because of the kids. It's for the kids, period. I think if our industry and our competitive natures could be set aside, as you say, and we focus on the kids and what's best for them, I think we would realize very quickly that we have to do the collaborative research mm-hmm. because it's best for them. It's not about us, and it's not about, you know, whatever, filling the beds or making a buck or whatever it is. It's about getting them home and well.
Mm-hmm. As quickly as possible, because nobody wants families to be separated for extended periods of time. But sometimes it takes some children longer to get to a point where they're able to go back home or get the family back home involved enough and make the changes they need to do to make it conducive for the child to come home and be productive there.
Absolutely. That's so critical. And I've been having lots of conversations with the board of the AACRC, and they have linked up with SAMHSA. SAMHSA in the past has been pretty opposed to residential treatment in general. And in the last 3 years, a guy named Bob Lieberman out of Oregon has done a lot of good work with SAMHSA. And Gary Blau, who's the director of behavioral services for SAMHSA, now counts residential treatment as one of the better ways to treat these types of teenagers. And it sounds ironic that you would take a teen away from his or her family in order to get them back to his or her family. But the reality is, as you know, that sometimes you need to do that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's not going to work in their community at first. So what you said about getting them back as quickly as possible is paramount.
But again, it has to be for each individual. And I was just curious, as you were sitting here talking, I was thinking about how Department of Mental Health have different facilities like level 1, level 2, level 4, level 6, level 10, level 14, you know, which is a locked psychiatric facility. And, you know, children fall into different categories. And when you take children, you've worked with foster care, you've had foster care children, you know, they go into different levels depending on their mental health needs at the time, or at least that's the concept behind it. I'm just curious that if there couldn't be like some national intake process where you find out what the needs are of the children, and then having all the treatment centers have some kind of system where, you know, they're a level C and they're a level A, and maybe they need C treatment, which will take 8 months, where a level A may be more immediate crisis and back home, maybe a level A. I don't know.
I love this creative thinking. I think that's, see, what I like about that idea is that I think our competitiveness paralyzes us mm-hmm. and gets us to kind of, gets entrenched, and we don't think in this direction where you're thinking about a national way of assessing. That'd be really an intriguing concept to kind of play around with. But we don't even start to have these conversations because we're worried about that we're going to look bad. So I like that idea.
Right, and I don't think anybody likes to be compared to everybody else. And everybody, I mean, I've heard all the pitches.
I'm sure you have, right?
And you know, it seems to me the more they try to push something, the more I'm thinking, okay, why are you pushing so hard? Because if you're doing that great of a job, won't it sell itself? It's important to know you exist, but I like to know the outcomes, like you were talking about. It's important that we need some kind of outcome research for these treatment centers. Now, I imagine there are potential problems in doing that or getting an organization to do that, because we're talking about it's going to take time, it's retraining people to write that. And I do know a lot of programs do write their outcomes, but they don't share that information with anybody.
Yeah, it's true. And you hit on a key point. I was up in Canada meeting with the Ministry of Health in Ontario a few months back and showing them our outcome studies. We've had about 4 years of those. And they said, well, this is all well and good, but what does it compare to?
Right.
And I was stumped because I had nobody to compare to. I really didn't have anything I could lay out for them. And that's kind of tragic, mm-hmm. you know. It doesn't mean anything in a vacuum. It needs some context. So I agree. It takes cost, you know, it takes a lot of cost, takes a lot of time. You have to kind of orient your entire organization culture around outcomes research. So it's not simple, but it's necessary, I think, to raise the bar.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you talk about outcomes, and we're talking about, you know, mental health and treatment for children, whether it be through substance abuse or cutters, a high-risk behavior or oppositional defiant or, you know, severe depression or whatever it happens to be. But I know with Department of Mental Health, you have certain outcomes that you're supposed to do in the treatment. And I think a lot of places are experiential and they use a lot of wonderful tools that are out there to help with the treatment that it's kind of hard to define the exact outcome and what did that particular treatment do, because there's not a lot of empirical evidence for a lot of different experiential treatments yet.
Well, this is a really key point. There's a big movement in our country towards towards evidence-based practice. I take a little bit of an issue with that concept, because in residential treatment in particular, there are so many factors at play that I think it's almost impossible, if not impossible, to isolate the secret sauce that helps somebody get better. So I think a better way to look at this is what Scott Miller calls practice-based evidence, where you just take your own facility and you come up with some, or find some nationally respected tools to measure yourself, and then just sort of compete against yourself and try to get better and involve your clients in that process, and then your particular practice is generating evidence that you can then tweak over the years. I think that's a much better way to approach it, and it sort of avoids this problem of applying, let's say, CBT to every treatment center or DBT to every treatment center when that may not fit for a particular client.
Right. I like the flexibility. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I went into private practice, is I have the flexibility to use whatever tools or whatever theory or combination thereof works for that particular individual. I don't think everybody's cookie cutter. And not everybody responds to certain things. And some people respond more to experiential, hands-on, more cognitive, more behavioral. It's kind of a combination of everything. But that's what makes us all unique, and all our children unique, and they have special needs and whatever that may be. And to support that and have residential treatment programs that are very specific for the individual child, because, again, like you, I think it's all about the child. It's like,
right.
What can we do and to help them?
I love the wisdom of what you said. See, someone like you has all this experience. We need to have people like you out there at the front saying, here's where we need to get to, because we have all these folks coming into the industry or, you know, becoming therapists, and they haven't had that track record. They don't have the history that you have. You know, we need to have people standing up saying, this has to happen this way, because I don't want them to recreate the wheel every time they come out of college, you know?
Well, that seems to happen. I see that a lot.
I know, it does happen.
Or they're very indoctrinated into whatever favorite teacher they had, whatever theory that teacher had, that's their theory, and they don't want to deviate from that at all.
Right.
But, you know, to discuss the need for tighter systems of care, I mean, to have some oversight to that, what are some of the things historically that treatment centers have done, and what do you think that they might need?
I'm glad you brought that up. The systems of care, I think part of the problem in our field is that you have all these passionate people who really want to help kids, who love kids, and maybe had a personal experience that brought them into the field, maybe a son or a daughter or themselves that were troubled. And they don't have any business experience. And it's almost taboo to talk about this, Nelda, you know, to say that you need to have some business sense, but you really do. I mean, to really serve kids well, you have to be able to manage, you know, your checkbook and run an organization and build a culture and you know, understand human resource policy, et cetera. So I think to raise the bar for our industry, we need to talk about inserting really sound business practices and principles in tandem with really sound clinical practices and principles.
Well, and that's interesting you bring that up, because that's the one thing that I've always heard people talk about, you know, that people going through master's programs and doctoral programs, there are no business classes on how do you run a practice, how do you run a clinic, how do you get grants, how do you work a nonprofit, how do you build a business so you could best serve your client. And there's no instruction for that. And I know most people that are clinicians go, well, I don't want to deal with numbers. I just want to help people. Right. I just want to talk. So the idea of sitting down, as you mentioned, doing a checkbook or even running a company, it just takes it to a whole different realm, which would probably scare off a lot of people. But that's why you hire people that know how to do it. But then the people that know how to do it don't understand the clinical aspect of it. I'm sure you've had all these experiences in building programs, but I know from my experience of working for many different agencies, what I found is, you know, they do the bottom line with about the money, and I understand that, but they don't understand the clinical process, and they forget that they're working with clinicians and mental health, and it's more than just the bottom line. There has to be a balance between the two and an understanding of the program integrating itself to help the clients.
Totally. That's totally true. We made a decision about a year ago that any program that we start or acquire or any of our current programs will be run by a clinician. That's a difficult thing to say and do because not, like you said, not every clinician has the skill set of a business person. And really in this day and age, in this economy, our companies need skilled managers and business people. So we spend a lot of time teaching and training. When I started running a company back in 2001, I was lucky enough to have a mentor who had been in the hospital industry for 25 years, take me under his wing and bring me along. I remember saying to him the first time we met, I remember saying, I'm a pretty good manager. I just need some help with some stuff. And he just looked at me funny. And I learned later that I was not a very good manager at all. And he was just keeping his mouth shut to be polite. And really, I learned over the last 11 years or so, 10 years, that there are some principles and skills that have got to be mastered or the companies will fail. And I think we've seen that in the last 3 years where there were some companies that just had some of the best people I've ever worked with, and they just got kind of ran into the ground because the appropriate business skills were not being applied.
Right, and I'm not naming names because I don't know the details of anything, but I know several excellent programs that have folded in this last year.
Right. It's really sad and tragic. I think that shouldn't happen. We shouldn't allow that to happen as leaders in this field. I think in terms of raising the bar, we've got to just reach out to everybody collaboratively and say, let's do this together. Instead of, for example, having a NATSAP conference be just about clinical stuff, let's insert more business practices into that. Or, you know, at IACA, for example, let's talk more about which business practices we're all weak at and what do we need to do better. I think this needs to be more open.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just curious, too, and I mean, we all have continuing education credits and we have to do as clinicians, and you know, you're talking about going to conferences and all that. It seems like they should probably mandate business, so many hours of business CEUs, I would think. That would be an encouragement for clinicians and people that work in agencies such as yourself to really start to understand the business model as well. Because if you don't run the business correctly, you're not going to have a business there to bring the children to.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, but
that's an excellent idea. We should. You know what? I bet you we could get some of the major boards, like AMFT or people like that. I bet you they would listen to something like that. That's a great idea.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm full of great ideas. Just, not everybody thinks they're so great, so it's nice to have some validation there once in a while. But I know that, you know, that kind of calls to the need for advocacy, I would think, for, you know, not only other organizations to collaborate together, but what are your thoughts about parents and other professionals to really push that agenda? And as a parent, because I know we have a lot of parents that listen, what should be their concerns or interests when they're taking a child to a program? Should they be looking for the program having had done outcome research, or is that really that important, or do they need to look at the track record, or what do you think?
I think they should look at all that. I don't know if for parents that are listening, there's a website called Building Bridges for Youth, the number four, buildingbridgesforyouth.org. And this is a SAMHSA, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Association, a federal program designed to help parents make choices around residential treatment. And it has a checklist, a very simple checklist they can go through and look at each program and compare them to each other as they're researching for their child.
Wow.
I think it's an elegant way of kind of ferreting out what's wrong with a place or what's right with a place. And we were part of helping edit that. One of our program directors, Chris Kilpatrick, sits on an advisory committee to the Building Bridges organization, and he was out in Omaha last year helping with it. It's really taking off. It's been about 3.5 years now, and there's more than 150 programs that participate across the country, and that needs to get much larger. But I think parents can go there and find a pretty slick way to measure programs.
So the 150 or so programs that are associated with this and that are on their list, do they report to them their measures or safety issues or their outcomes in order to be ranked by them?
Oh, I love that. No, it's not a ranking.
Okay.
I want to come back to what you just said because I think that should happen, by the way. But no, it doesn't happen right now. It's not a ranking necessarily. It's more of a like a checklist that SAMHSA made up for parents to use.
Mm-hmm.
So they can compare themselves. The parents compare the programs themselves. The programs have not submitted any data yet.
Okay.
But some of us are pushing for that. I think that's a great idea, and I think it needs to happen. I mean, can you imagine if every program across the country that participated in the Building Bridges Initiative, if they all had a parent, for example, in their program, assess them according to this tool, and then submit that data? That'd be phenomenal.
Yeah. Well, I keep thinking of safety issues and things, and I'm thinking like injuries. I would think a wilderness program, you might have a few more twisted ankles than you would in a residential setting in the middle of the city. I don't know. So I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if reporting that there were so many injuries at this place compared to this place doesn't mean that the place with the injuries, they didn't, you know, have better outcomes at the end. So who knows? I mean, it's really subjective there. But
yeah, that's true. For minor injuries, I agree. I think if we were to say, and I think OBHIC, the outdoor behavioral health folks, have done this for a long time. They've kind of led the field in terms of researching safety in their programs. But I think if we all agreed that there were four major ways that a kid could really be seriously hurt or die, mm-hmm. and those things are runaways, serious injuries, med errors, and restraints. If we could just agree to track those four things all together and define those the same, I think that's what Joint Commission tries to do, is have a common language of definition. If we could agree on those things and compare data, I think it wouldn't really matter if I had more or less. It's just we're tracking the things that could really hurt kids. So,
well, what might be some barriers to doing this, do you see?
Oh, I think the same thing that we've been talking about, unfortunately, you know, having people not want to publish that data. I would hope that people would collect this anyway, whether they're going to share it with each other or not, but that would be a problem. I talked to a facility in California the other day that I saw, they let me see their numbers of safety numbers, and their incidence of restraints was in the thousands. For 1 year, I thought that was just unbelievable.
And you're mentioning restraints. I haven't heard people doing restraints unless they're in the locked psychiatric facility, or, you know, there might be some momentary restraints when they're pulling people apart from fighting or something, but nothing, or to prevent them from hurting themselves. But are you talking like bound restraints? Like
No, just like what you're talking about.
Oh,
but
okay.
The way you just said it is exactly the point that I'm trying to make, is that how you define the restraint, whether it's just pulling two kids apart or just putting your hand on their shoulder, you know, whatever your state requires you to collect, or your county, in some cases, that sort of muddies the water, and we don't know that we're comparing apples to apples. So
right.
A restraint for me might be anything that's, you know, over 15 minutes, let's say. And hands-on. It might be for a psych hospital, it might be drug-induced, or it might be straps, but
right.
We need to kind of have a common language.
Well, that would be helpful. But, you know,
yeah.
But, you know, I just keep thinking, too, about the families' involvement. I know there's some programs that really emphasize the families must be involved or they won't even touch the child, and others that will take the child whether or not the family's involved, or now they're using more new technology such as Skype, so the family, if they're across the country, they can at least be seen by Skype, which is better than on the phone or not seeing them at all. But what are your thoughts about that?
Well, this is my favorite topic. The families have got to be involved, period. What are some of the programs that you mentioned that won't take a family if they don't all commit to participate? I've been sort of humbled in the last year or so as I've interacted with people with the AACRC. These are folks that take state contracted kids or county contracted kids whose parents sometimes are not interested in being involved. Mm-hmm. And they have given themselves the goal of involving those parents. And so I see them as fairly heroic in their efforts to require and cajole and encourage the parents to participate. The more we just know that, I mean, isn't this just common sense? We've known this from the research and just from common sense that the more the family's involved, the better the treatment outcomes are. Mm-hmm. And I think we've sort of convinced ourselves that we just sometimes can't do it, or it's too hard, or the parents are crazy, or whatever excuse we use, and have talked ourselves out of it. I think that's part of raising the bar, is to just get back to the roots of the child and get back to the reason why we're in this in the first place, which mm-hmm. is to get them home.
Sure. And I'm going to have to stop us for a moment. I just looked at the clock, and we need to do a quick commercial. But we are talking today on Answers for the Family to Dustin Tibbett, licensed marriage family therapist and CEO, and does everything at New Haven and Interchange. And hopefully we'll talk about that for a few minutes when we get back. Stay with us. We'll be right back to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back to Answers for the Family. I'm Dr. Melody Fox, clinical psychologist and marriage family therapist, and very thrilled today to have our guest, Dustin Tibbett, who is a licensed marriage family therapist. He works with Interchange, which programs include New Haven, Sunrise, Felshire Ranch Academy. And again, welcome back to Answers to the Family. And we were talking right before the break, we were talking about parents and them being involved in some programs, being more involved than others. And to take that a step further, making that transition of bringing children home for the families, or home from the ranches or wherever they're at, treatment centers, back to the family, there's a transition that takes place there. And I think that's where the family involvement really is important. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree. I think we've known for a long time that it's not the length of stay that makes the difference in treatment. It's the way the transition is handled. Mm-hmm. You can have a kid stay for 6 to 8 months in a program and another one in the same exact program stay 10 months, and that's not really going to be the difference maker. It's going to be how well did we transition back to her home and set up support services. So I think we've done a fairly poor job in our field of really investing the resources and the time into making that work well. There are a handful of programs that I think are doing a pretty good job. You know, Homeward Bound, for example, has got a pretty robust and really ingenious way of doing it. Vive is another one. I know Second Nature's got a 360 program that seems really great. So there's a few that are doing pretty well, but as a whole, I think we're behind the ball.
Mm-hmm. And how important would it be for a family to step up and say, hey, you know, you're doing a great job with my kid there, but, you know, I'm participating as I can, but what do I do when they come home? Do I find my own therapist? You know, do we need to do more family therapy? Do I need to, you know, do we need to move to another city? You know, what do we need to do?
Exactly. Here's what I worry about, Melody. Maybe you can speak to this too. Is just, you know, once they kind of are in crisis when they come into the program and they don't ask that question in the beginning. It's once they're in and approaching being done, then they start asking that question, and by then it's a little too late to rally that organization into some kind of transition care if they don't have it. So,
well, I do know there are specialists that do help with that. I've met several. I can't think of names right off the top of my head, but there are people out there that will help with the transition between bringing a child home from a center and connecting them with other resources in their community and making sure there's communication between where they came from and where they're going, which
that's true.
Continuity of care is really important, I think.
Well, I think some educational consultants will do that. You know, some of the better ones have got themselves set up to broker some kind of bridge between the program and the next placement, or, you know, the outpatient therapist at home or whatever. So I think that's good.
Well, as far as transitioning back to the home, what is the key for success there of making it work, do you think?
We have a lot of experience with that. We over 90% of our kids go home, which is really unusual for a residential treatment center. And the reason that we can do that is because we spend so much time on the families when they're here. You know, that statistic alone would be pretty so-so, unless you have my favorite statistic, which is that 87% of kids never go back to long-term care. So I think the things that they can do is start planning for transition right at admission, and getting the parents geared up with a plan. The master treatment plan shouldn't just be about treatment. It ought to be about the end result, which is getting them home. And I see too many treatment plans, and you probably have had this experience as well, I see too many treatment plans that are geared just on reducing symptomology instead of helping the entire family cope with what life's going to be like later. I think we're experienced enough to know that, you know, this is not a magic pill that we take and everything's better. So sometimes people are going to be struggling with things the rest of their lives. We need to help them.
Right.
Help them out.
And it amazes me, though, how many families say, you know, here's my child, fix them. And they don't, you know, they don't realize that change takes time. It took, you know, 15, 16 years for a child to get to that point, and it's going to take time to come out of that point. And there are no magic pills, and there's no timeline, and everybody's slightly different. But I think what's important, too, is with the family involvement is the relationship with them. And I think your program deals a lot with relationship-focused therapies, which I think is really, really important as well. It because the relationships are going to shift. They're going to change, because when one person changes in the family, it could be upsetting for the better or for the worse for other members of the family. So they have to adjust to all that and learn how to relate to each other in a different way.
It's so true. It's a whole system. I love that you're a marriage and family therapist, that we can have this conversation about systems, because it's not like sending a car away to be fixed. You know, I think we've westernized treatment in such a way that we think in a medical model that, you know, you bring them in and we do some surgery and they're done. But I think it's much more holistic than that. It's much more of an Eastern philosophy of a process and a journey and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're treating a whole person, and there's much more than just the behaviors. That's why I like the cognitive aspect of cognitive behavioral, because it kind of combines the two. What comes first, the chicken or the egg, you know, the behavior or the thought, or changing the thought. But then also part of that, too, is your soul and your relatedness to other people in your life, and how you relate to other people and relate to yourself in your own life. So it's a combination of everything. I think one of the things, although I love evidence-based, because you can measure it, and when you work with Medi-Cal or work with DMH, you have to be able to demonstrate some kind of progress, and that's a way to do it. However, a lot of the relationships, it's so varied, and there's so many variables, I think it would be hard to really kind of put numbers on it, so to speak.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. It's hard to put numbers on it, especially you said the relatedness of us and working with the whole person.
Mm-hmm.
We struggle with this here, but how do you measure the impact of relationship? It's easier to take maybe a behavioral treatment modality and try to attach some numbers to it and measure it. It's more difficult to take a relationship-focused therapy and track it, mm-hmm. from start to finish and beyond. It's a little more difficult, even though we know that relationship is really the thing that motivates most of us to change.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't figured out how to quantify that.
Right, and because it is so subjective, what makes a good relationship? That's different for everybody.
It's true. It's very true. Scott Miller has this new organization about a year and a half old called the ICCE, which is about helping therapists be better. And part of the frustration, the reason that he started the foundation was because he kept saying, well, it's the relationship that's most effective. It's really the relationship is really the only thing we have much control over in the change process.
Mm-hmm.
And people started to build a model around it, and that wasn't the point. The point was not to create a new model. The point was to call attention to the ridiculousness of assuming that any one model was a silver bullet.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So he created this Center for Excellence for therapists to help them improve. But, the challenge that we're having is trying to figure out what is it exactly we're trying to improve? What is the skill set that really helps? And you're talking about relationship. What does make a healthy relationship? It's a little bit more difficult to nail down, although I think we need to do it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, we only have about 10 minutes left, and I want to make sure we talk about interchange a little bit. So what is interchange? Just shift the focus a little bit here.
Okay. Interchange is a family of treatment centers. There are three treatment centers right now, New Haven, Fullshear Ranch, and Sunrise. And we have a common purpose of healing generations through girls. So we treat only girls and young women. And our goal is to use relationship-based therapies, sound business practices, solid research outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
And get the kids home faster. That's sort of the uniting principles that guide interchange. And so the programs that belong to us now and in the future, we'll have to sign up for that.
Okay.
So that's us in a nutshell.
Okay, and your mission is to... You finish the sentence. Our mission is to...
Our mission is to heal to heal generations. That's the bottom line, and we've accomplished that through women. We feel like if we can treat one young woman... And she turns her life around. Then she has, in turn, saved her future generations.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really inspiring for us.
I really like that when you say, generation of women's or women. It just gets passed down. It's like the chicken and the egg. You stop the cycle that isn't working, and you find new ways to doing that, and they learn new tools, so they pass that down to their child and continues on in a much healthier way, hopefully. Now, I know you're very family oriented there. So can you talk about the family's involved?
Say that again.
How do you involve the family? Because you are so family oriented in your programs.
Oh. Well, I think our treatment centers, as I've traveled around the country and visited over 100 treatment centers, I think our family involvement is second to none. We require them to be out here as often as possible, at a minimum every 8 weeks. We require them to do exactly the same things we ask their children to do. For example, our values program, which is what we call the Family Works program, it requires the parents to be on a values-based level system just like their daughters. So it's not uncommon for a treatment team to be talking about the family every week and decide that, while Sally was on her home pass, her father, got drunk and we need to drop dad's level. It's a pretty powerful intervention for a child to see that she's not the problem by herself and that dad needs to do some work too.
Oh.
So that's one example of a way we involve the family.
Well, and also if you think of family systems and all that, it's not usually one person. But one person usually gets identified as the problem, but it's the whole family as a whole. Something's off, something's not working, and everybody has a role.
Exactly. I think part of a family-based approach is also non-judgmental. So it's not so much about let's dig into this and figure out who went wrong. It's more about let's dig into this and figure out what we all do next together.
Oh, sure.
That's a much more, you know, non-shaming approach.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now, I do have a couple listener questions, and one I think has to do with dealing with your Falshear Ranch because you do equine therapy there that I know of. But this listener question says, we own a small dude ranch in Northern California catered to families who stay with us for 1 to 3 weeks at a time. And I've noticed that some children do well with the horses, but there are a good 30%, I would estimate, who want nothing to do with even the gentlest of our horses. And we're always concerned for their safety because all this seems to stem from fear, which the horses can sense. I was wondering if you had any specific approaches in those first few days when you start beginning to work with the animals. So I don't know how much your personal experience is with equine therapy, but can you address that at all from what you know of your program?
Sure. I'm not an expert in horses at all, so let me qualify that. I have been EGALA trained and have worked with the horses and the kids in therapy settings. And I would say that our approach is not to force any child into any particular modality in the first place. So if we've got a child who's, you know, seriously afraid of horses, I don't plug her into the clinical program and say you must do what everybody else is doing. And we just work on it gradually and get her to the point where she wants to. I mean, that's the whole power of equine assisted therapy, is the people who are in there in the arena with the horses, you know, really want to interact in some fashion with the horse because it's safer for them. They perceive the horse as safer for them. So I would say, you know, not every modality works for every person. And if I've got a girl at Falshear Ranch, we're not going to, you know, twist her arm to do it.
Mm-hmm. So you just respect where people are at that moment of where they're at.
Well, yeah, my friend Dave Pryor, who runs Sunrise, he likes to say just that we meet each family where they are at. And that's one of the strengths, I think, of his program.
Mm-hmm. And I had another... I mean, I'm just kind of going fast because we only have a couple more minutes, but I have another listener question for you. One is, my daughter was at a therapeutic facility for almost a year before she turned 18, and I was so happy to read about the focus is to prepare young people for adulthood and their future in the outside world. What specifically do you do to uncover the talents and fuel their ambition once they return home from your program?
Well, that's a very good question. I think... in order to uncover their talents and help them do it after they get back home, you have to actually be at home and see them interacting. And so we send our therapists out to do coaching sessions with the family in their home, wherever they may live in the world. And then help that child and the family set up services around her. Let's say she's into art or music or rock climbing or whatever, and find those places in the community that they might not be aware of, and then get her practicing. So when she's home on a pass, she makes sure to schedule a session with her music teacher or her rock climbing instructor. Falshear Ranch Academy is actually the best at doing this. That's all they do is transition work. That's the whole point of the program. So they take 18 to 25-year-olds who need to be, you know, in an apartment or at college or at a job. And so, the question is really valid.
Wow. That's really phenomenal because you don't hear of a lot of transitional age programs.
You
hear of, okay, we do 18 and over, but it's geared towards adults that really already have a life out there and don't need a lot of transition. Or it's under 18 and we work with the teenagers and get them back home. But I'm just like, wow, that is fantastic. I'm glad to know that you exist with that.
Thank you.
So do you limit it 18 to 25, or what age did you go to?
18 to 25 is Falshear Ranch. Mm-hmm. New Haven and Sunrise serve 12 to 18.
Okay.
And Falshear has the most robust transitional services. Mm-hmm. Sunrise has the second most robust transitional services because they're based right in town, and New Haven is geared more towards treating complex traumas, and the transitional services are probably third on the list compared to the other two.
Wow, thank you. Well, Dustin, we're just about out of time, but I want to make sure that people have your websites if they want to contact you or gather more information. Would you mind sharing that with us?
Yeah, thank you. It's Interchange, I-N-N, interchange.com is the way to find us.
Okay, and then you also mentioned buildingbridgesforyouth.org as a resource for families. And, of course, we'll have all your information on our website, which is www.answers4thefamilyblog.com. That's answersforthefamilyblog.com. And please join us again next week. And, Dustin, thank you so much for your information. And I'd love to talk with you further on the advocacy for getting some kind of system together so people could be, I know we did talk a lot about it, but to make sure that our children are going to a really good program and exactly what they need. So thank you again.
Thank you, Mel. You've been very kind to me. Thank you.
Have a great day. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.